But the kind of metaphor is what's called gauni, where the connection, the literal thing is not true, there's something connected to it. But what it is that's connected is a quality, a shared quality. Now we're going to look at that right now, so let me read ahead. Gauni, he calls it gauni now. We had guna before, but it's the actual term is an adjective, gauni. Gauni lakshana. So it's feminine because the implied noun is lakshana. Gauni chabi hitarta lakshita guna yukte tat sadvishe yata simho devadattaha yata hu abhideyavina bhuta pravittir lakshaneshyate lakshamana gunai yoga vittir ishta tu gaunata. Okay, and what is this a quote from? TX, what's TX? I'm sorry, I can't easily tell you what the book is. It may be Sahitya Darpana, maybe. I have to open another file that's not on this machine that interprets these codes I'm using. Matsu, you have the newer version of the files? Okay, you can look in the footnotes, it'll be spelled out. Footnote number 654. Tantra Vartika, okay. It's Kumara Labhata. You see, these terms are originally defined by the poets or by the Kavya Shastra authorities. But Kumara Labhata, the authority of Mimamsa, is also dealing with it. He's defining it in his book. Because for interpreting scripture, you also have to deal with these different levels of meaning. Just like you can take someone to court for calling you a pig, and you can argue in front of the judge, I'm not a pig, I have two legs, not four. But then the other side can argue, well, you have qualities of a pig. You know, so in questions of interpretation, these are significant, these understanding these different usages of words, meaning, word meaning. Okay, now, let's go back to this, what we just read. Let's translate it. In qualitative usage, I'm translating gauni as qualitative usage. That's a confusing term, but it matches gauni. In qualitative usage, one refers to something that possesses a quality of what is literally denoted and is similar to it. For example, Devadatta is a lion. So lion has a literal reference. It's a certain animal. When I call Devadatta a lion, I'm expressing the idea that he shares some qualities of lions. Not that he has lots of hair all over his body, but some other qualities of lions. That's gauni. Something possesses a quality of what is literally denoted and similar to it. The prowess, the courage of a lion, the strength of a lion. I think I'd rather make qualities plural. Let's leave it single. Okay, as it is said by Kumara Labhata, he's summing this up because in this verse he defines both regular lakshana and gona. Some theoreticians consider lakshana and gauni to be two different things. Some consider gauni just a subdivision of lakshana. It doesn't really matter. We could go either way. So Kumara Labhata is splitting them up into two different categories. He says, usage not unconnected with the literal meaning is called lakshana. And usage by connection with qualities figuratively referred to is called gauni, qualitative. Like the village on the Ganga is actually talking about the shore of the Ganga, which is connected to the Ganga. But when a similar figurative usage is referring to a quality, then it's called gauni, like Devadatta's a lion. Does that make sense? Any problems with it? I'll read the next paragraph. Iha lakshana cha rudhim prayojanam va pekshyaiva bhavati. Figurative usage, moreover, more specifically, is based on either convention or special purpose. I think gauni is only on for special purpose, not for convention. Now, what does that mean? Is based on either convention or special purpose. Based on. What is it? In other words, what is the figurative usage trying to do? What are you trying to express by it? Okay. Well, you may be expressing something special, or you may just be using a phrase conventionally, not really saying anything special. Now, here's examples. Adya yata kalinga sahisika. Ante yata gangayam goshaha. And an example for the first is Kalinga is restless. Reckless. Is that a word? Reckless. What does it mean? It means asahisaka. He's rash, yeah. And for the second, there is a cowherd village on the Ganga. Atra tatasya shilatwa pavanatwa dir bodhanam prayojanam. Prayojana means special purpose. In the second case, the special purpose is to make known the coolness and the sanctity of the shore. The first example, Kalinga is reckless. Now, Kalinga is actually the name of a country, but the king is called Kalinga. That's figurative usage, to call the person by the name of the country. But it's done all the time with kings. It's just convention. Nothing special is meant by it. Why do you call me Kalinga? You know, there's no special purpose of it. There's nothing to get insulted about. It's just convention. Kings are named, there's a sutra for that, isn't it? Kings are named after the country? Yeah. It's just a grammatical convention. But when you say there's a cowherd village on the Ganga, there's something special, there's a special idea that's expressed by that. That place where the village is, that shore, is cool and sanctified. Ah, I was right. Gaunyam tu prayojanam evapeksham. Qualitative usage, however, is only based on special purpose. Oh, I had it the other way around. Yata gaur bahika. The bahika man is a bull. I didn't translate bahika there. One of the definitions that Moni Williams gives is a certain low-class, kind of low-class Punjabi. But I don't want to say, put in Yoga Swami's mouth, the Punjabi is a bull. So. Yes? All right, well, Moni Williams doesn't say all the Punjabis, but a certain tribal from Punjab. I was playing with it, but I finally decided not to get in trouble. I just said, the Bahika man is a bull. This, for example, has a special purpose of making known the person's great ignorance and so on. Okay. Bannon, yeah. The worst things would happen. They'd come here and chop my head off. Okay. Continuing. I read that. Agyatwadi ashishaya bodhanam atra prayojanam. Yogas tu etad trivida vritti pratipadita padartha yor pravritti prakriti pratiyartha yor yogena. Okay, now we're talking about yoga. This is sort of a change of topic. We have conventional usage and conventional meaning and derivational meaning. Yata pankajam aupagava pachaka, three different words. In these three kinds of usage, primary, figurative, and qualitative, word meanings are established by derivation, by combinations of the meanings of words, word bases, and their inflections. Examples are found in the words pankaja, alpagava, and pachaka. You can see their suffixes on those words. Panka is, and then pankaja means born from mud. Of course, it has conventional aspect to it too. We can call, a poet could call, you know, a frog pankaja, but it's not the conventional usage. The normal usage is it means a lotus. They're both born from the mud. So that's both yoga and vritti. Upagava, that means descendant of Upagava? Upagu? Okay, well anyway, it's you can understand the meaning of it derivationally. Person descending from Upagu. Upagava. And Pachaka. Well, the person who does the action of pachdhatu, a cooker, a cook, is called pachaka. That's also a derivational meaning. We understand the meaning. You don't have to establish a special convention. You can understand it grammatically from the application of the suffix, if you know what the dhatu means. Let's see what the commentary says. Kalinga is the name of a kingdom, but by figurative extension, the names of kingdoms can also refer to their rulers. As described earlier, the primary meaning of words can be established either by derivation or by convention. Figurative and qualitative usage are based on primary meaning, and therefore it's primary meanings. We started with that, with mukhya, the primary, the literal meaning of a word. And we said before that that can be either derivational or conventional. The figurative and qualitative usage is based on the primary usage meaning. You have to have a primary meaning first of a word, and then you can extend it by lakshana and gauna. But so still, because they're derived from primary meanings, the secondary meanings, they also involve the same two ways of being established, by derivation or by convention. Here are three examples of derived words. Pankaja means lotus, because a lotus is born from mud, panka. The proper name Upagava is derived when a special suffix is added to the name of the father whose name is Upagava. Pachaka, one who cooks, is formed from the verb pach, to cook, by the adding of a suffix that indicates the performer of an action. Okay. Any questions about that? Yes? But we're not going off on any tangents yet. Okay.
I'm just trying to recap all this section and just what you just said also. So, first comes the mukhya meaning. First comes the mukhya, which is the primary meaning.
Yes.
Then this mukhya is extended as lakshana or guni.
Yes. And next we're going to find even a third extension.
Right. Then in mukhya there's vrudhi and yoga. Vrudhi is conventional.
One or the other usually.
Yeah. So one or the other. It's vrudhi or yoga.
What is that? What is vrudhi and yoga?
Vrudhi means conventional and yoga means...
Conventional what?
Well, the conventional usage, like for example,
well, it's the origin of the meaning. Where does this meaning come from?
Is from
the meaning comes from derivation or it comes from convention? It's the origin of the meaning is either conventional or grammatical or both. So it's describing not the meaning actually, but properly speaking, the source, the origin of the meaning.
And then...
Because meanings don't just... They come from somewhere. Words are given meanings, even if God does it. Or some, you know, special convention of divine sages, you know, that we never heard about, you know, sits down and just decides what words are going to mean, what meanings. But they have a basis on which they do it. They do it either on the basis of convention or on the basis of grammatical derivation. Yes.
So Rudi convention yoga is derivation.
Yes.
So Mukhya has Rudi or yoga.
Yes.
And this Rudi and yoga is also carried forward to Lakshana and Guni.
Well, because the Lakshana is based on the, is connected to the original meaning. It's Mukhya. A takeoff on the original meaning.
Yeah.
Even if the original meaning is abandoned, you know, still we started with the original meaning. The word Ganga means, is the name of a river. Even if it turns into a shore, the word Ganga still means the name of the river. And that word Ganga is conventional. And so my figurative uses of the same word, it's still the same word, it's also going to be conventional. It's still the same word. It still came from the same origin.
So
you know, if I move to California, my life will change. You know, I'll dress differently and eat differently and have different habits, God forbid, if I ever do that, than living here. I'll be a different person. But my father is still the same person. No matter where I live and what I do, I still have the same father, the same origin. So no matter what happens to a word, no matter what secondary or tertiary meaning it takes on, it still has its meaning, its original literal meaning still has the same origin. Just like whoever I become, I still have the same father, no matter what.
And now in this section that we just saw, they say that they start to go further descriptions of Lakshana and Guni, and then they say in Lakshana there's the Rudi and the Prayojana.
This is the purpose. What is the Lakshana expressing? Yeah. No, I'm sorry. What is the Lakshana doing? Is the Lakshana expressing anything special? If it is, if there's some special idea you're trying to express by it, then it's called, there's Prayojana. It's Prayojanavati Lakshana. It's got a special purpose. But some figurative uses don't have a special purpose. They're just conventional. To call the king Kalinga, you don't mean anything special by it. You know, Kalinga is a country, it's you know, the coastal area of Andhra Pradesh. So the people at that place are mostly fish eaters. But you're not implying that the king's a fish eater by calling him Kalinga. You're not implying anything.
Because you're...
So, see, the yoga and Rudi are where the word came from. And now the Prayojana or just Rudi are where the word's going to.
So
what further idea it may be expressing?
I'm just my confusion is that the word
Rudi is used in both senses,
but it has a different meaning in the sense that I'll explain.
Because one of them is conventional origin.
Yeah.
The other one is conventional outcome.
Is that one is the meaning of the word is Rudi or yoga? And now the usage...
Not the meaning is yoga. The meaning comes from
yoga.
The meaning is created by yoga. There's a difference. The meaning is created by either yoga or Rudi.
Yeah.
It's prior to the... It's the... Anyway, it's the cause of the meaning of the word.
So this first...
And now we're talking about the result of the meaning. By using a figurative usage, what's the result? If it's conventional, no special result. If it's Prayojanavati, we actually get a special idea implied by it.
So one is understanding the meaning of the word, and now this is speaking about the usage of the word.
No, not the meaning. The origin of the meaning.
Okay.
Get that.
Okay.
So, it's not the meaning itself. It's the source, the origin of the meaning.
When you speak of Rudi and yoga of Mukhya, we're talking about the origin of the meaning of the word. And now in this connection, when we're speaking about the Rudi and Prayojana of Lakshana, we're speaking about the usage of the word.
Let us say the consequence, the result of using that, of making that figurative usage. People use words literally, and sometimes they use them figuratively. Why do they use them figuratively? For what purpose? The answer is no special purpose, just convention. And the other answer is they have a special purpose sometimes.
The result of the meaning.
The result here. The result of the meaning. The source of the meaning, the result of the meaning. Okay. Now, we have one more. These are called vrittis, shabda vrittis. Modes. Vritti can mean mode. Like, you know, my word processor is in overstrike mode or insert mode. So we can use words in these modes, and here's another mode that we haven't mentioned yet. An important one. It's a tertiary, the third level. What? Yes? Go ahead.
I'm trying also to understand this last paragraph.
Yes.
Thank you. This last paragraph discussing the yoga.
Yes, explaining how, because we already talked about primary meaning derived from ruti. Now we're talking about primary meaning derived from yoga, and then this also extends to the secondary meanings. Okay. All, you know, if the primary meanings are derived by yoga, then the secondary meanings are also.
Because in the translation, I don't understand the shift of idea now we're speaking about yoga. In the translation, I feel I don't get that.
Yeah, I see what the problem is.
Like the words, the word meanings.
Like yeah, I think something was lost in the editing.
Yeah.
Let me just mark it, okay?
Like an adjective around the word or
the
meaning.
Yeah, well, I'll think about a solution. Let me just mark it that as a problem.
Okay, thank you.
I got to mark this in another color because I already used red. Hold on a second. Ah, Krishna. It's going to be orange. I don't have any orange here. Gray. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next paragraph. Vyanjanabhida cha vrittir manyate. Yata gangayam gosha ityukte tannivasa bhutasya tattasya shitalatva pavanatvarikam gamyam ityadi. Also acknowledged is the usage called suggestive. Vyanjana. It's also called dwani or echo. For example, when the phrase there is a village on the Ganga is spoken, implied are the coolness, sanctity, and so on of the shore on which that place of residence is found. Now, we already said that. We said that that's the purpose of that lakshana, that figurative usage. But what we're identifying here, that purpose actually amounts to a third level of meaning. It is suggested meaning. So the purpose of the lakshana actually is a suggested meaning, a third meaning. This is very important, because at least according to the theory that our acharyas accept of poetry, without such suggested third level meaning, you don't have poetry. It's just ordinary language. But for words to make poetry, you have to have suggestion, third level meaning. Okay, I'm continuing. Taduktam. This 662. What's the reference? The end of that paragraph? Well, the end of this paragraph. Taduknam is a whole long four-line quote. This is Siddhanta Darpana. Taduktam shabda buddhi karmanam viramya vyapara bhava iti nayen abhida lakshana tatpari akya su tisvishu vritishu swam swam artam bodhiyitvo pakshina su yayanyo tor arto budyate sa shabdasya artasya prakriti pratyayades chashaktir Vyanjana, Nigamana, Dwanana, Pratyayana, Bhavabi, Prayadi, Vyapadesha, Vishaya, Vyanjana, Nama, Iti. Vyanjanam is a neuter noun, but we're using a feminine form here because it's a Vyanjana Vritti. So it's a Vritti. Vritti is feminine. Actually, Gauni Vritti. It's not Gauni Lakshana, but Gauni Vritti. It's a feminine noun. Vritti is a feminine noun. Such suggestion is described as follows by Vishwanath Kaviraj, who is not Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He's a poet. His textbook is actually less important than the Kavya Prakash of Mamata. It's less original and less authoritative, but it's very well accepted in Bengal and is quoted by Krishnas Kaviraj in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the Sahitya Darpana. And here's a quote from the Sahitya Darpana about Vyanjana. It is reasonable to say that when words, ideas, and activities cease, they have no more function. Thus, when the three functions of word meaning, called primary, figurative, and intentional, have each revealed their own sense and have ceased to act, yet another sense is revealed through another power of the meaning of words and of the bases, inflections, and so on that make up those words. This power, called Vyanjana, is also variously referred to as, these are different names for it, suggestion, interpolated meaning, reverberation, implication, inner sense, and purpose. These are different words that have been used by different authorities for the same thing. Important point here is, once the literal meaning is expressed, there's no more power on that level. If you want to squeeze something else out of the word, you have to go up to the second level and look at the figurative meaning. And once you've identified once the figurative meaning is there, that power is expressed, it's used up. And you want more, you have to go to the third level and see what the suggestion is. So when the first and second level energies have been used up, the arrows have been shot and they're gone, then you may go up to the third level. If you're speaking poetically, if it's ordinary prose, you usually don't go up to the third level. Yes. Yes, see, Vyanjana can be suggested on any of those three levels. There's Abhida Vyanjana, there's Lakshana Vyanjana, and Tatparya Vyanjana. These are all different levels of meaning. So each one of them can do their own suggesting, each level of meaning. The literal meaning of the word can suggest something, and the figurative meaning can suggest something else, and if you have an intention of the author that's identified, that can suggest something else. And here we say not only the words, but even their bases and inflections. Just like I can say, please go, I can say it politely with a vidi lin, or I can say it rudely with a plain vidi. There's implication by that, by which inflection I choose, which tense. There's suggestion involved that may be expressed just by the inflection, by the choice of tense, or some other choice.
Yeah, we didn't have Tatparya yet. Like, what would be an example of Tatparya?
Tatparya has been mentioned. Tatparya is only some theoreticians take Tatparya to be another vritti. So I think the Jiva Goswami is just leaving it off on the side, mentioning it, but not seriously considering it as another vritti. We already have four now. Tatparya would be the fifth, or this would be the fifth, and Tatparya would be the fourth. But more normal among poetry theoreticians is not to count Tatparya as another vritti. They recognize it, that it's significant what the author intends, but they don't count it as a vritti. So in the discussion of vrittis, we're just mentioning it, but we're not dealing with it as a separate category. But it has been mentioned already. Remember, we were talking about the Vedas not having a Tatparya because they don't have an author. So we're not getting into a systematic discussion of what Tatparya is, because it's not really a vritti anyway. at least in this system, this analysis, it's not being considered a vritti.
What would be an example like of a tatparya meaning of a word for?
Yes. So you know, one gopi is sent on a mission to deliver a message to Krishna, and you know something else went on beside that, and then she comes back, and her mistress who sent her is actually mad at her. I didn't send you to do such and such with Krishna. I just sent you to deliver a message. She doesn't say that. She says, "Thank you. You did a very nice job." But you know she's mad. You can see in her eyes. So when she says that, she says it very ironically. You know, "I'm very pleased with you," but you can see in her face she's furious. So that's the tatparya. "I'm really fed up with you for doing this, but I'm openly saying I'm very pleased with you." So the tatparya of it is just the opposite of what you seem to be saying. And that certainly suggests something. Yeah. That makes it poetry. You know, that you're being told, "I'm very pleased with you," and it means just the opposite. That's a poetic expression involving a vyanjana that's derived from the tatparya. Not derived from anything else. It comes from the intention of the speaker. Yes.
So suggestions means so whoever reads it, they will be getting the suggestions, or this suggestive meaning is perceived by some group of people.
Yes, some groups. It has to be special people. First of all, when we go up to that third level, we're coming up to the level of poetry. It's no longer ordinary language anymore. Now it's special poetic language, which is capable of expressing rasa. Rasa has to be suggested. You can't describe prema or bhava just by saying the words. Prema, prema, prema. It doesn't give you any idea what prema is. But if you use vyanjana, if you use expert suggestion, you can give an idea. So that's poetry, especially transcendental poetry. It has to have vyanjana as its, what is it called? The life air of poetry is the vyanjana. That's what gives it life as poetry. Otherwise it's dead, it's not poetry. It may look like poetry, but without vyanjana it's not poetry. Now, so therefore, not everybody can understand poetry. Certainly not everybody can write it, but also not everybody can understand it. These are the connoisseurs. Or the Sanskrit word is sarvideya. Someone who can sympathize, who can vibrate along with the poet. Sarvideya. He's got a similar heart. Or a sympathetic soul. Sympathetic not in the sense of you feel sorry for the poet, but sympathetic in the sense that you vibrate along with him, like sympathetic strings on an instrument, on a lute. Sarvideya. So that's very special people. The qualified audience to understand poetry, especially the more elevated forms of poetry, very special people, very limited audience.
Also, among those special limited audience, is it that there's a common suggestive meaning, or for each different suggestive meaning comes out?
Shouldn't. That's not good poetry. If it means something different for each person. Because the author is trying to say something, and he's trying to make definite suggestions. It's his job that the reader gets the same message. If I, especially even on the lower levels, if I say something and you get some other idea, that means I failed to communicate. You know, I'm telling you, the book is over there in the second Almira on the middle shelf. And you understand that to mean the first Almira on the bottom shelf, then I failed to communicate, or someone has failed. I failed to communicate, or you failed to hear it. And especially on the higher level of suggestion, if you get a different idea than I meant, that's a failure of communication. So it's not like everybody can find their own suggestions. The author creates suggestions, and the competent hearers, audience, are supposed to catch the same suggestion. Not like, you know, we create a radio broadcast and people in their radio sets just pick up, you know, some vibration and turn it into anything. It's supposed to turn into the same program that we broadcast. So it should be the same suggestion. The same suggestion that the author sent out should be received by the hearers, by all of them. And if someone's receiving something contrary or something different, then there's something wrong. Either the author didn't know what he's doing, or the hearers are not competent. That's what it means to be sympathetic, is that you're catching the same message that's being sent out.
The audience, each of them might be having many different nature, and they have different conceptions, and in the sense they may be having a set of ideas in their mind while reading. Yeah. So when they read a particular poetry, it might kindle different thoughts in them. In the sense,
well, that's unintentional side effects. That's unintentional side effects.
That's not a disturbance.
You know, when you use language, it's not complete telepathy. You know, a complete sharing of minds. The minds are still separate. You know, I may have had a very bad experience when I went to Kanpur. I may have had the worst experience in my life there. And when the poet mentions the word Kanpur, I become terror-stricken. But it's not the intention of the author. It's just my quirk that the word Kanpur sets me into a fit. You know, that's an accident. That's not an intentional act of communication. It's not part of what the poetry is supposed to do. It's just a side effect. And there always will be such side effects. But the actual act of communication, whether it's prosaic or poetic, is to convey a message. And it should come across, not turned into something else. There may be static, just like, you know, you hear a radio broadcast and there's also static in the background. Or you're hearing someone speak, you know, I'm speaking, but you're thinking about something else. So I'm not responsible for that. Something else is going on in your brain. That's your inattention. That I'm talking about such and such and you're thinking about, you know, something totally different. That's not a failure of communication. That's a failure of attention on the part of the hearer. Or being distracted. So we're describing what language does. Language, all I can do is talk. And you can either hear it or ignore it or pay half attention to it and daydream, you know, with the rest of your mind. But all I can do with my language is express something, and hopefully you'll hear it and understand it. But language can't be held responsible to completely take over your brain. You know, you have to actually use your ears and listen and pay attention. So this question of, you know, I say a word and you get some idiosyncratic suggestion in your mind, that's not part of the poetry. That's just some static going on in your brain. And it's not a fault of the poetry. It's that your brain's a little bit, you know, it's doing its own thing. It's not listening to the poetry.
So there is a specific...
You have to tune in to hear poetry. You have to tune into it.
There is a specific type of prayer called Ninda Stuti. Does it come under suggestive or figurative meaning?
What kind of stuti?
Ninda Stuti.
What is it?
That externally it might appear as if...
what is it called?
Ninda Stuti,
yeah. I gave that example of the angry gopi saying you did a nice job. That's Ninda Stuti. That involves, yes, that's a category of suggestion, yes.
But that was externally appearing as a glorification, but actually...
Yeah, suppose
it can
someone...
be the opposite way also.
Yes, but that's intentional. That's the intention of the speaker, or the author who wrote that poem about the gopi. Now, suppose someone listens to it and doesn't catch the idea. He just hears you did a nice job and he takes it on face level. Then he misses the point. You know, that means that's a failure to receive the communication properly. He doesn't see the irony in it, just out of ignorance or inattention. There's nothing wrong. That's not a fault of the poetry, it's a fault of the hearer. But poetry, it's a fault of poetry if the suggestions are vague. They should be clear, that a competent hearer should be able to catch the idea. If they're left too vague, that's a fault of the author. if the suggestions are too vague, or contradictory, or there's other faults. There are faults that could be, that could ruin the suggestion, and that makes poetry third-class poetry. There's some suggestion, but it's not a good suggestion. It's a vague suggestion, or a contradictory suggestion, or other faults. That's what qualifies bad poetry.
If you could kindly explain, summarize the difference between a vyanjana or suggestion and tatparya intention. The difference between the two.
Well, better we don't think of tatparya as another power of words to express. Tatparya is really a concern when there's ambiguity, when you could mean two different things, or more than two different things by what you say. Bring the saindava. Now, saindava can mean salt that comes from Sindh, or it can mean a horse that comes from Sindh. Now, I'm not saying anything figurative. I'm just saying, could you pass the salt, or could you get my horse ready? Nothing poetic involved there. There's no vyanjana. All I want to do is get the salt and to put on my sabji, or get the horse so I can go somewhere. There's no subtle implication. So there is no vyanjana there, but there is tatparya. You know, I say to the butler, my servant, bring the saindava. Now he's got to figure out which one I mean. Are we sitting at the dinner table? Or am I at the front door with my coat on and my shoes on, ready to go somewhere? From the context, you can tell which I meant. That's the tatparya. No suggestion involved. And you can have... Well, you could say suggestion involves an intention. But the technical meaning of it... When an author says it, something, he's always intending something. He means to say something. But we use tatparya to distinguish when there's ambiguity, when there could be confusion about what he means. The context in which you decide what he means, that's the tatparya. Otherwise, in a less technical sense, there's always a tatparya. There's always an intention. But it's intention when it's crucial. When without knowing the intention, you can't figure out what's meant. When there's too many possibilities. Then you look at tatparya. If I say, you want 10 rupees? Go get me, a bottle of soda from the store. I'll give you 10 rupees. You understand that clearly. If I go get that bottle of soda, I get 10 rupees in my pocket. It doesn't matter what I meant by it, what I want to do with the soda, or why I want it, or what's my purpose, all you care about is the business exchange. You get the 10 rupees. There's no tatparya there. It doesn't matter what I intended in that situation. So you don't look at the tatparya. You just decide, do I want 10 rupees? Do I want to take the trouble to walk down the street? There may be an intention, but it doesn't make any difference. So we don't look at it. But when it's significant, when it makes a difference what the author meant, when the meaning can change, then we look at tatparya. Yes. Go ahead.
So this will help me to also understand here. This is back to the qualitative usage.
Why?
You
want to go back to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is connected to this. So is in this quotation that was given, is that Goni is a subdivision of Lakshana, or it's two different things?
Here, there's two different ways of handling it. The majority of theoreticians, anyway, I don't even know the statistics, but many of them consider it a separate category, and many of them don't. For some theoreticians, it's a subcategory. For some, it's a separate vritti.
But in
it doesn't really, you can do it, you can categorize it either way.
Okay.
Here it seems like we're treating it as separate.
different.
Okay. Because we're following, Jiva Goswami is quoting Kumaralabhata and doing it his way. And Kumaralabhata is identifying two different things. One is Lakshana and the other one is Gauni. But I think Mamata in the Kavya Prakash considers Gauni to be a kind of Lakshana. Lakshana, Lakshana, and Gauni, Lakshana.
And
but it, there's no contradiction. It's just, you know, it's just the choice of which way you want to subdivide it.
And Vyanjana
is a whole, it's a third mode of meaning.
Third mode of meaning.
If you take Mukhya, Lakshana, then the third one is Vyanjana.
Vyanjana, but I thought there was third.
Okay, if we make Gauni the third, then Vyanjana will be the fourth.
Okay, but it seems that Vyanjana is a subdivision of Lakshana.
No.
No?
It is not. No statement to that effect.
No?
Vyanjana, first of all, you have to... Vyanjana is derived, suggestion is made by the literal meaning or the figurative meaning or the tatparya. Vyanjana, the origin of Vyanjana can be any of the three.
Yes.
And it can also come from words, it can also come from meaning. Like the suggestion can be based on the particular words, or it can be based just on the meaning. You could change the words, you could paraphrase it and still get the same Vyanjana. Then it's based on the meaning. If you can't change the words, if you can't paraphrase, but you have to use exactly those words to get the suggestion, then it's word-based. Shabda Vyanjana and Artha Vyanjana. It's a third level of meaning. It's based on the earlier ones.
So, what brought this confusion was the example that was given, because when we speak of Lakshana, we speak of the Rudi into the Prayojana.
Yeah, but okay, and I pointed out that when we said that this saying, there's a village on the Ganga, has a purpose. It has the purpose of implying the coolness and the sanctity of the shore. That actually is Vyanjana. You can identify that purpose as, what's the purpose of the Lakshana? To bring out a suggestion. Okay. What's the purpose of the figurative usage? It's to create a suggestion. So in this case, not all cases, but in this case, the purpose, see, it's just one example. In this case, the purpose of using, of figuratively talking about the village on the Ganga is to make the suggestion that village is a sanctified, cool place. And that is Vyanjana.
And is this Vyanjana that's given an example...
It's not the same as Lakshana. It's derived from... It's created by Lakshana.
Okay, so this Vyanjana was... Like, this example of... There's a village on Ganga is a Vyanjana who was suggested by Lakshana.
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
You want to get more into detail on this, you can read the Kavya Prakasha or the Siddhanta Dharpana, and we have some parts of them translated into English. We have that second chapter that deals with the vrittis in an English translation of the Sahitya Dharpana.
So those who want to study more poetry, specialize in that.
If you really want to. We'll be studying this in the third year. Okay. One last question, and then we stop.
This poetry has this third level of meaning, and it has to suggest something. But what about like some poetry wherein somebody is glorifying Krishna and he's saying that, "Oh my Lord, just by a fraction of your energies, you create, maintain, and sustain all the material universes."
Yes.
So. What is the Vyanjana then? Vyanjana may be that I surrender to you. That may be the suggested meaning, that I take shelter of you. He's just glorifying. He's not suggesting anything.
Maybe he is. If he isn't, then it's not poetry. Because if you want to argue that the Bhagavad Gita is pure poetry, okay, but you'll have to show the Vyanjanas. You'll have to show the suggestions. We have a book upstairs describing the poetry of the Mahabharata, pointing out all the vyanjanas that, that the author has found in the Mahabharata. You can, and the Bhagavad Gita is part of the Mahabharata. So there is vyanjana there, but you want to show that it's pure poetry. There's not one verse that, that lacks vyanjana. Sometimes it takes a very, very expert eye to find them. A competent hearer may be verberate, but he may not be able to identify them consciously. It's one thing to be a sympathetic hearer and to catch the suggestions. It's another thing to be able to analyze them. That's more difficult. And so not everybody can, not even all these competent hearers can analyze what's going on. Now, if you want to analyze, it'll take quite an expert to analyze how the Bhagavad Gita is pure poetry. You have to actually point out the vyanjanas. You may be affected by them, but you may not be able to consciously identify them.
Same in the case of the Bhagavatam is considered a poetry completely, or is it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the statement by Vopadeva, and he's a Mayavadi, but he's quoted by Jiva Goswami, is that the Bhagavatam speaks in all three voices. The Vedic voice of injunction, the Puranic voice of advice, and the Kavya voice of suggestion. It's one of the voices of the Bhagavatam. Now the question is it poetry throughout? Is all of it poetry? It speaks in poetry, but does it always speak in poetry? I would like to say yes, but it would have to be demonstrated. You'd have to show that every verse in the Bhagavatam is good poetry, is excellent poetry. We should do that. Someone should take that as an assignment. But you have to become expert in the theory of Shaptavritti to do that. Demonstrate that every single verse in the Bhagavatam is first-class poetry. Uttama, uttamottama, super first-class poetry. When you have vyanjanas that further reverberate into more vyanjanas, then you have uttam utta, you have super first-class poetry. Not just reverberation, but reverberations that reverberate into more reverberations. That's super first class. If you want to show that Bhagavatam is super first class poetry in every verse, go ahead and do it. It would be a noble task, but it would take some effort.
It's necessary to be every verse, because those chapters which are describing...
Well, then you're just proving that it's pure poetry sometimes, but better to show that it's always pure poetry.
But as a collection of verses, like for example, when there's listing of names of kings of dynasties, so then it's not just one verse speaking, there are tens of verses going on and on, speaking the list of names. So then if we say that there is a vyanjana here that, well, there have been so many dynasties and so many kings, so...
Well, then you have a Pokarana vyanjana. The whole section has a vyanjana. You know, the whole big section, not every single verse. But then you've said then that the verses aren't poetry, some of the verses are not poetry. Maybe. And, you know, our religion doesn't depend on the fact that every verse in the Bhagavatam is poetry. Yeah, it doesn't have to destroy our faith if it isn't. And then one more.
Slesha, it reveals vyanjana.
Slesha is a particular
when the author
is an art alankara. It's a figure of an ornament based on meaning.
But it suggests.
Based on the word. I'm sorry. It's a shabda alankara.
It's by slesha something some other.
Yeah, because vyanjanas can be created from vastu or from alankara. Vastu is just the story. The plot, the story, what's being told. That can create a suggestion or an alankar. Shlesha is one out of 60 alankars, 65. That an alankar can create a vyanjana.
So whatever we see in the commentaries when commentators say Shleshana, da-da-da-da.
Yes.
So whatever they explain, the Shlesha, it's actually a vyanjana.
It's a vyanjana created by a shlesha.
Yeah.
It's a vyanjana created by an alankara. But it... Yeah. It's a sub-subcategory of vyanjana. You can read in Kavya Prakash, that's described in detail. Also in the Alankara Kostava of Kavya Karnapur, it's described. And the... I don't know what he says in Bhakti Rasamrita Shesha. Sit up the comedy. Yeah.
All the verses, all the karikas and so on, they're just straight Siddhidharma.
And the examples? No.
I think some of the examples, he uses his own examples from Gopajampur, he uses Krishnadas Devaraj's examples from Govindalila.
But he does discuss these subcategories of Vyanjana, no?
Well, one thing he says about Sleshra, it's not always that it's Vyanjana, because...
No, not always. Yeah. No, it's just one possible source of Vyanjana is that it can come from an Alankar, including Shlesha Alankar.
Right.
Not that every time you use an Alankar, it creates a Vyanjana. It's the other way around.
Right.
Some Vyanjanas were created by Shleshas or other Alankars.
Yeah. Because if...
You can have an Alankar that's just icing on the cake and doesn't do any suggesting.
Right.
And then that's not even poetry.
Right.
That's not even poetry. It's just fancy talk.
Yeah.
When you create, by some means or other, you create a Vyanjana, then you've got poetry.
Yeah, because like when you do like a sabanga slesha, you could just be having two different words which both have abhida vritti.
Yeah, you have a pun.
Yeah,
pun can just be gibberish. You know, it can have no... You know, it's just funny use of words. There's nothing poetic about it. Unless you're making a serious suggestion. Okay, let's stop now. This is a topic, an interesting topic, but it really has to be dealt with separately, you know. You know, actually have a course on it for a few weeks or months. I'm sorry.
It's about Srimad Bhagavatam, how it's poetry, all through. It says there in Chaitanya Bhagavat, Pratishloka Pratya Akshara Nana Arthahaya.
I'm sorry, Ken.
Pratishloka Pratya Akshara Nana Arthahaya. Srimad Bhagavatam is...
Pratishloka Bhadyavatyapi. Right? Is that what you're talking about?
No, this Chaitanya Bhagavata's statement, Prati Shloka, Prati Akshara, Nana Arthahaya, Srimad Bhagavatam is...
Every word and every syllable has several meanings.
Unlimited, Nana Arthahaya.
But those are different kinds of meanings, not only Vyanjana.
So what I wanted to suggest is that as Vyanjana is supposed to evoke a particular emotion which doesn't derive from the direct meaning of the word, the Srimad Bhagavatam may or may not do it on the emotional level or intellectual level, but it does evoke each and every syllable and each and every verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, since it's spoken by Shukadeva Goswami, evokes love of Krishna, which is the highest emotion, and which may not derive even sometimes, like Bharatram Prabhu was saying, from the description of the kings.
Okay, but be careful not to use... be careful that you're not using the same word suggestion in a non-technical sense. It doesn't just mean evoking an emotion or evoking an idea. Because direct meaning also does that. If I mention the name of someone you love, just mentioning the name, just literally, will evoke an emotion. Or if somebody you hate intensely, I just mention his name, and your adrenaline starts flowing. That's not Vyanjana. That's done simply by Abhida, by Mukhya Vritti. But that's non-technical suggestion. We're talking in the technical sense of a poetic meaning, poetic suggestion. So, one thing that we can say is the Bhagavatam is pure rasa, Shastra. Pibhata Bhagavatam rasamalayam. It's rasa all the way through. No pit, no skin. It's all juice, the Bhagavatam. That's the third verse. States the claims that. So there's rasa expressed in every verse of the Bhagavatam. But you cannot, you can suggest various things. Like, I can get your bile flowing by just mentioning somebody's name. But that's not Vyanjana. But prema cannot be invoked. Rasa cannot be invoked in the same way. You cannot invoke rasa just by saying a word. Or even by a figurative usage. You must use Vyanjana, dwani, to evoke rasa. No other way, as far as language, you know, awakening it. The only way that language can awaken rasa is by Vyanjana.
So that's what they want to ask if...
Well, then the argument can be given. Since there is rasa expressed in every verse of the Bhagavatam, then there must be Vyanjana.
Exactly. That's the point.
Yes.
If it evokes rasa, and we should have shloka, even talking
there
about...
There can't be... Rasa cannot be expressed otherwise.
That's the point.
Just by saying rasa, 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 that doesn't evoke any rasa.
As you explained in your seminar on... What was that, on the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, that Shukadeva Goswami, when he was speaking Srimad Bhagavatam again, he was repeating it verbatim after Vyasadeva, but Vyasadeva himself said, listen, because there was something different
in what he heard from Shukadev Goswami that from what he had written.
What could be different? The words are the same.
His own poetry.
Well, it has to do with Tatparya, because it's what's going on in Shukadev's heart that adds something to it. Because the same words are being pronounced on his lips, and it's not that he's saying things with some ironic intonation or something. It's not no trick of that. It's just his consciousness is different. It's special. He's adding something to it by his own consciousness. So there are additional vyanjanas created by Shukadev's special consciousness.
Because you could argue that vyanjana's ability to evoke rasas is based not just on the words themselves, but also on our inbuilt feelings and kind of preset mind towards vyanjana. So if everybody has a predisposition towards loving Krishna, if it's evoked in the best way by Srimad Bhagavatam, that's a perfect poetry.
Just like I can sit here for 6 hours and give a very learned discourse on the intimate aspects of rasa. But because my rasa is the rasa of eating stool, therefore it will have no good effect. It will be impotent. My talking about things that I have no realization of. I can say all the right words, and I can go on for hours, or even months, years, talking very expertly, because I learned all the jargon, and I know how to mimic it. But I have no realization. So therefore, nothing's evoked. The real rasa is not evoked. Because I don't have it. I can't give it.
Just like today, Maharaj in his class spoke about building buildings, and he evoked the rasa of surrendering to Krishna as a result. So it's Maharaj in his class.
Yes, yes, yes. Because he's speaking from realized experience. No, we'll do it tomorrow. Oh no, we won't do it tomorrow. We'll do it Sunday. I'm going to Delhi tomorrow. That's okay. We'll recapitulate. We'll go back to the beginning of the discussion of Vyanjana and continue. It's an important topic, but we're not going into the great detail here. Jiva Goswami's not. You want a whole discourse on Vyanjana, read the Lamkar Kostava. Okay. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Shri Tattva Sandarbha Kijaya.